the world of Sonic the Hedgehog, a new hero arrives.
I am
ready. Is there anyone stronger?
No.
Tougher?
No.
Funnier?
I do not make jokes. I make warriors.
Knuckles, now streaming only on Paramount Plus.
Yes!
Welcome into the Ops and Audibles podcast, post-game edition. I'm Matt Brady, Merrick Scopel on the show as always. We are recording from our hotel room after a very exciting 34-31 victory by the Oregon Ducks over the UCLA Bruins. We've had a good opportunity to kind of talk this game out. Eric and I picked up some dinner, got out of Rose Bowl a little later than normal, so we're apologizing for getting this up so late. But a game that, boy, it could have gone in so many different directions. It could have been a blowout loss. It could have been a blowout win. It could have been an epic collapse. And it ends in a win.
And it ends up being what every Oregon game it feels like this year is, which is like a one-score game where the defense has to defend the lead at the end. Literally, this feels like kind of a carbon copy of the last three games. Obviously, Stanford, they lose. But again, because of some ineptitude on offense, which we have to get to, which, by the way, followed some really great offensive play. Oregon's defense has to make a pick at the end of the game, or else this one goes to overtime, and maybe they lose. And like you say, it's a huge collapse, because Oregon's up 17 points, three plays into the fourth quarter, and it really felt like, boy, this is it. Here they've come. They've turned the corner. That game we've been waiting for has arrived, and Oregon is going to put together a really strong final three quarters of the game. They started slow, but they'd scored 34, almost on 34 and answered, 34-3 run.
Yep.
after UCLA scored the first two touchdowns, and it just felt like, okay, here it is. They're going to do it. And then it's interception, touchdown, and suddenly UCLA has the ball near midfield with like 45 seconds to go.
And what?
And we're all kind of like, is this going to happen again? Is this going to be another Stanford game? And it turned out it wasn't quite that, but it's a win. DJ James saves the day with the interception, and here we are now reflecting on a team that's bowl eligible, which means
not even a story.
I was going to say, which means nothing to anyone listening. Like, I don't even think we've talked about the fact that they're bowl eligible. They now have won six games, and it's a team that you can now point to and say there's another, I don't want to say marquee win because UCLA now has three losses, but it's another very respectable road win.
This is the stretch that Oregon went in about a five-possession game here. Or five possessions. 12 plays, 87 yards, touchdown. 12 plays, 80 yards, touchdown. 6 plays, 75 yards, touchdown. 4 plays, 22 yards, touchdown. They then had a 4-play, 24-yard drive that ended with a fumble, but the defense gets the ball back on a turnover on downs by UCLA, and they go 3 plays, 62 yards, touchdown. Like, I think that was probably the best stretch of football, offense, defense, special teams, that we had seen all year. And I kind of talked about this on my story on DuckTerritory.com, that if Oregon could just capture that 35 minutes of football and bottle it up and reproduce it on a consistent weekly basis, they are a top three team in the country. And we are talking about this team as a legitimate contender to win it all. And this is a complete perfect example of this entire season for Oregon.
Yeah, it is, and it's also, I think, totally encapsulates the quarterback issue.
Yes.
Because we have to say this. After Anthony Brown has his 43-yard touchdown, which is Oregon's last touchdown of the game, we turned to each other and said, Pac-12 Player of the Week?
Yep.
Like, Pac-12 Offensive Player of the Week? Because at that point, he had about 280 yards passing. I think he had, like, 8 incompletions.
85 yards rushing.
85 yards rushing. It was just like, wow, what an incredible game from Anthony Brown. And you saw it on social media. I posted something saying, like, hey, credit to him. And people were really gung-ho in supporting him. You saw it on DuckTerritory.com, the message board. Fans being like, all right, he's proving something. Here, this is what he's going to be all year. Let's get behind him. And he really felt like he won the fans over. And then he comes out and throws two of the worst picks you'll see in a season in about, I think that was a consecutive possessions.
Yes.
And suddenly, Oregon's basically playing a game that felt completely over is suddenly really, really competitive at the end here. And there's a lot to unpack here because I don't know why they're throwing, especially on the second one, period. But gosh, I think we saw kind of the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde of Anthony Brown, just like this whole team.
The first interception, he came out and flat out was like, yeah, that was horrible. That was bad on me. I should have ran it.
Yeah.
Shouldn't have thrown it. He instantly, in the media room, knew the fault, knew the solution, knew what he should have done. The second one, Mario Cristobal said there was a miscommunication. Anthony Brown didn't really talk much about it.
Cristobal said it was a non-QB issue, which is like, okay,
what does that mean?
Yeah.
But the issue is you brought it up, I brought it up. They never should have been throwing in the first place.
Yeah.
In that drive, when they're up 10 points, or at that point, they're up 3 points, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
They're up 3 points, and UCLA has just scored back-to-back touchdowns, and all of a sudden we have a football game. The offense just made a horrific play. That drive was going as it should have.
Mm-hmm.
8 plays, 51 yards. They chewed up over 3.5 minutes of game time. They didn't have to throw. And so while it was like just a monumentally awful throw.
A bad throw.
By Anthony Brown, and he plays a fault in it. The main fault is on Joe Moorhead and a Mario Cristobal for calling the play in the first place.
Yeah, Anthony ends up making the bad decision to throw the ball where he throws it, but that should not have been a passing play. So here's where the circumstances were. It was 2nd and 9 at the UCLA 24 with 3 minutes to go. UCLA had just called its second timeout of the half. They had one timeout left. Hypothetically, let's say Oregon runs it up the middle and maybe gets, let's say, 5 yards on 2 runs. Suddenly, it's UCLA's out of timeouts. Oregon has it maybe like 4th and 4.
Yeah.
4th and 3, let's say, something like that, with like a minute, 45, 2 minutes to play, and they make a decision that, hey, if we get this first down, the game's over, or we kick a field goal, go up 6, and we trust our defense to protect this, where UCLA can't kick a field goal to tie it and force overtime. They have to score a touchdown to win, and they have no timeouts, and they have to go the length of the field with an offense that's not built to throw the ball down the field. Just a really bizarre sequence, and I don't quite get it. In part because it feels like they didn't learn from what happened against Stanford. Because it was poor clock management there where they threw it, and again, we've now gone back and watched that play, and it was a screen pass set up to Travis Dye, where if this is back in the Stanford game, where if it was a complete pass, he might have scored, or it would have ended the game. But this is one where it's even more perplexing, and I just don't understand these end-of-game situations here where why be so aggressive there? The payoff is maybe you throw a touchdown. And what ends up actually happening is you end up throwing an interception and really giving UCLA a new life. And part of me, and I asked you this on the Uber drive back, like, if Dorian Thompson-Robinson doesn't get hurt,
Does UCLA win?
UCLA might win.
Yeah.
Probably do. I mean, they at least put themselves in a better spot to tie it.
I don't want this podcast to turn into a negative.
Yeah, let's focus on some positives.
Because there were negative. Because I'm with you. Like, there's so much I want to talk about that's from a negative standpoint. But this team won.
Yeah.
Against a team in the Pac-12 and UCLA who's probably one of the better teams in the league. I mean, they throttled LSU earlier this year. They have a very veteran team. I think was it you that brought it up, or was it Cristobal that said that, like, their offensive line or their
yeah, it was Cristobal.
O-line, D-line have more seniors on the two deep of those two position groups than Oregon does on its entire roster. Like, this was a very solid opponent that Oregon just beat. And they probably show to some voters that they're better than what their top 10 ranking is. Because let's be real, like, yes, they've not been blowing some teams out of the water. But at the same time, they should be ahead of a couple other teams.
Mm-hmm.
And this is going to open the door for that. Oklahoma State lost this weekend. Penn State lost this weekend. You've seen a couple other teams go real close to losing. And so I don't want to be so negative, but this team's 6-1 now. They're probably going to be 8th in the country. Mm-hmm. They're in the driver's seat to win the conference. And I think for two quarters, we saw the potential of this team. And they could be really, really good. And Anthony Brown was a big contributor for that because they could not run the ball. And they needed Anthony Brown to play like that.
I was just going
to
go and say Oregon scores 34 points here and has basically no established run game from the running backs. Like, it's okay, this is, we talked about this at dinner. It's so funny because Travis Dye sets an NCAA record, 4 touchdowns on 4 consecutive carries. Never happened before. His longest run for the day, 6 yards. 14 carries for 35 yards, a very underwhelming effort. By the way, it sounds like he had a migraine pregame and was questionable to even play, which is like kind of like, wow.
Just totally Oregon's luck.
Like, wow.
Like, your most like versatile player doesn't get hurt, but he might not play because he's got a freaking migraine.
Like, how? Like, what? Okay. And Anthony Brown was really, really effective throwing the football for all huge portion of this game. And it wasn't, by the way, just screen passes. There were some screen passes that were successful. They had some success there. He threw the ball down the field, and I guess down the field by his standards of 15, 20, 25 yards down the field pretty successfully all afternoon. You know, Devin Williams had 5 catches, 80 yards. A lot of those were down the field. Micah Pittman, same thing. 5 catches, 46 yards. One of those was 29 yards, and that was a really good throw down the field. John Johnson had a long catch that was down the field. You know, they're collectively, the passing game was at its best. Threw for 296 yards. That's a season high. Again, they threw the ball for 296 yards. They only ran for 121. I think that tells a pretty clear story about, like, where the success was found. And we knew going in this was the case. UCLA, not a good pass defense, a very good rush defense, and all that kind of came together. Kudos for Anthony Brown for getting them there. And for this passing game taking a step, I just think it's a little bit underwhelming and a little disappointing that you have to put the but at the end there.
Yeah.
Because it's Anthony Brown played great, but
he almost lost the game for you.
Yeah, and I just, it's really frustrating because I won this podcast. I was hopeful this podcast could be a, I'll eat crow. I was wrong. Anthony Brown showed us something here. I want to see it a couple more weeks, but maybe he's really figured it out. And instead I come away going, like, the highs of the passing game were the highest of the season, but the lows were arguably the lowest because you almost cost yourself a game by 2 really ill-advised passes. Again, I don't know if I understand the strategy on even attempting a pass on the second one, but collectively it's just a little disappointing that we have to say that. But I also now want to turn and talk about a lot of the positive stuff because I think there is quite a bit to
like.
What's
the one that stands out the most?
The biggest positive?
Yeah.
Kayvon Thibodeau?
Very true. Very true. He was very good.
He was quite good.
To quote Mario Cristobal, he was solid.
Which was funny because it sounded like, I guess, Kayvon was sitting right next to him. And I was kind of like, wow. Because Kayvon Thibodeau, 9 tackles, 4.5 tackles for the last 2 sacks. You had some data. What is it, the 6th player this season, the NCAA, to do it?
Yeah.
And the first Oregon player since Nick Reed in
2007.
I mean, an incredible performance. His best is a Duck, I think.
This was a game where, I've said this to you, you've heard this comment, so it's nothing going to be new to you, but when Kayvon Thibodeau gets drafted in April and ESPN throws up the highlight package and Mel Kiper and Todd McShay are just going crazy over highlights,
mm-hmm.
This is going to be a game where if ESPN really wants, like, they just show all games against UCLA.
Yeah.
Like,
every play.
He was unblockable. And we're trying so hard not to go negative, but this was a game where multiple times in this second half in particular, it was confirmed to our eyes that Kayvon Thibodeau should never be dropping back into coverage.
Yeah.
And instead should be just straight up going crazy at the quarterback because for whatever reason, we continue to see teams either go, hey, let's put our right tackle one-on-one against Kayvon Thibodeau, or let's put our left tackle one-on-one against Kayvon Thibodeau, or even crazier.
Yeah, okay, this is my favorite.
Let's go tight end against Kayvon Thibodeau.
Which, by the way, results in a blindside sack of the quarterback and a fumble, which was, I mean, honestly, I'm watching that going like, why? Like, I just, like, what?
Kayvon Thibodeau was like playing on Madden with rookie, and you've got like the best defensive end in the game, and you're just going crazy collecting sacks. Like, he was straight up unblockable, and gives you an idea of just, I think DJ James' game-winning interception. I think his first interception.
Yeah.
I think multiple throws by Dorian Thompson-Robinson landed incomplete because Kayvon Thibodeau and this pass rush with him on the field is so much better. I mean, how many times did I lean over to you and be like, Dorian Thompson's dead?
Like three or four times. And somehow Kayvon is credited with one quarterback hit, which I would imagine is probably closer to like a dozen.
Yes. He was phenomenal. One of my friends messaged me in a group chat on my phone during the game saying, enjoy this because we might be watching the best defensive player in our lifetimes at Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
He's playing at that level where it's that kind of a conversation.
And you go, and I start thinking like, man, it's a real, and we talked about this also after the game, Matt, of like, it's such a bummer that his freshman year, he was great, but half the year he wasn't starting. 2020 was half of it was a COVID year. 2021, which is going to be his last season, everybody knows it, he misses basically a third of the season with injury. And now we've seen two consecutive weeks, by the way, one of which was a half of a game against Cal, what it looks like when he just is at his best. And it's unbelievable. And I have a hard time seeing an offense find solutions for this. And that's why I think going forward, I mean, we can talk about a lot of the reasons to be somewhat pessimistic if we want, but like, I feel really optimistic now about this defense against just about anybody, because when he pins his ears back and just goes upfield, I don't care who the quarterback is. I don't care who the left tackle or whoever is in front of him is. It's an issue. He's going to make plays. And boy, I mean, 14 tackles for loss as a defense, by the way, he had 4.5 of those. Collectively, Oregon's defense deserves a ton of credit. This was a UCLA team that was averaging like 230 yards rushing coming in. Their running backs, who we were all week talking about how good they were, Britton Brown and Zach Charbonnet, a combined 80 yards rushing on 30 carries.
That's really good.
Unbelievable. I
mean, that was so good that Mario didn't know the stat, and he was read that, and he almost was at a loss for words. Like, you could see it in his face. He was just like, whoa, I did not realize we played that good against the run. Like, he had an idea, but when you put data to, you know, off data perfect, you know, ideas, he was blown away. He had no idea that they did that good. And this is a UCLA offense that we mentioned at the beginning that they are so senior laden up front along the offensive line. This was the second best rushing offense in the conference. You know, they averaged 219 yards per game. This is a defense going into the week that's third in the conference in rushing touchdowns. It was 16. And Oregon pretty much bottled them up. And how many times this year have we talked about, oh, look how bad Oregon's run defense is against Stanford and Cal. We said the same thing. So those two teams, not good running teams, and they put up good numbers on Oregon.
Second half, this is even more impressive. Second half, I just saw this now. Second half, UCLA, 20 rushes for 17 total yards. Some of that's the sacks, right? But regardless, 20 times that were, you know, charted as a rush for less than 1 yard per carry for an entire half of football. And this is why I come out of this going like, if they can play like this consistently against lesser offenses, which frankly they will be facing, especially against the run. The only other offense the rest of the year they'll face that'll be comparable, maybe two, Utah, and then obviously Oregon State. Oregon State has the best rushing offense in the conference. We won't get into too much Oregon State talk here, but they had a pretty darn impressive win, by the way, at home against Utah shortly before we started recording this. But my point is, there's no reason they can't shut down opposing run games like this. Colorado next week at home could be a game where Colorado doesn't do a whole lot because they can't throw the football, period. And I would think that the way this Oregon run defense performed against a much better UCLA run offense should be primed for a game where it is just a very minimal day on the ground for the Buffs. And this defense, when it wants to, plays at such a high level, and yet you look up and you see they scored 31 points. And part of that is, I think, a little misleading because the first two drives of the game, Oregon was not on their A game,
right?
Did not play very well. There was a blocked punt that led to a short field for a touchdown. And then at the end of the game there, I hate to say it, it's frustrating because this team doesn't play very well with the lead.
Yeah, isn't that weird? Like, this is a top 10 team that when their backs are against their wall, like, I'm paraphrasing here, but Mario Cristobal says they play at their best. Like, they almost are, like, hey, if we need to reach optimal levels of execution, we need to have our, you know, we need to win or we go home with a loss type of a scenario. And yet this team, it was like this way against Ohio State, just holding on by your fingernails in that win, the last, three or four drives of the game. And then this one, it was the same way. It's backwards. You would think top 10 teams or elite teams that are in this kind of scenario aren't really maybe behind very often. And so it's a, oh, wow, we haven't been in this situation in a long time. How are we going to respond? Whereas they're used to putting teams away. And so it's just like clockwork. And it's inverse, which is strange to think about.
Yeah, what do you make of the defense right now? Because I'm really encouraged by Kayvon Thibodeaux. I'm encouraged by the play at corner, frankly, because I think, I mean, some of the stats here are pretty, and again, we talk about the rushing stats here, but some of the stats for UCLA, pretty darn impressive. You know, I mean, Kyle Phillips has 8 catches for 73 yards. Pretty much all that's underneath.
Yep.
Greg Dulcich is maybe the best tight end in the conference. 4 catches for 51 yards. And this is an offense that really didn't produce much of anything from an explosive play perspective until the last part of the game. I think collectively Oregon at all three levels played really well defensively. I guess I just want to see it for all four quarters. And the thing that's perplexing is also the way this game starts, where the offense looks really ineffective early, and the UCLA offense just moved the ball right down the field in that first drive. It was a very discouraging opening drive of, okay, UCLA goes 75 yards, 12 plays, takes 5 minutes off the clock, scores a touchdown. The next time down is a short field because of the blocked punt, like I said. But those first two drives, I think we both looked at each other and went like, this is...
Why'd we come?
This is, yeah. Well, I mean, we should... And that sounds... Those listening are like, wow, you guys should... What are you talking about? And we should note that there's a little story to that because we both had terrible travel days coming into this.
Both flew in day of.
Yeah, we both had to get up at like 4 in the morning and two flights down. And Matt had a much better success rate with his Uber. I did not. I had to take like a $115 Uber from LAX that took about an hour and 15 minutes. So I got there right before kickoff. And then to see Oregon just play pretty flat in the first quarter and go down 14-0, it's just kind of like, oh, that's a lot of effort for not a lot of fun. And then they turned around, like we said, played great in the middle of the game. I just want to see that consistent effort both sides of the football all game. Maybe that's too much to ask. I don't think it is. I think this team is talented enough to do it. You see in stretches just how good they are. And that's the thing. It's like that 34-3 run was so impressive on both sides of the football and all phases of the game that I kind of go like, let's just see them. If they can unleash that for a full game, you got something. But we've also been saying this all season, and yet this is the trend, is really, really close, narrow wins where you're having to make plays in the final play, you know, part of the game to ensure you come out with a victory.
Oregon is bowl eligible. I think it tells you the expectations of this program from even like 15 years ago. That felt like, not maybe like, hey, my God, we're bowl eligible, we're going to a bowl game. But it's like, hey, cool, now we're actually playing for like, how good of a bowl game we're going to, whereas now it's like, cool, you made a bowl game. Oh, you're going to go 6-6. You might get fired. Like, that's kind of where the expectations are now, it feels like, with this team. But I'm with you on the defense that looking ahead, the reason I'm talking about bowl eligible and 6 wins and whatnot, like, I don't know if there's a game on the schedule remaining now, seeing how the defense is playing with Kayvon Thibodeaux in full go, this team getting healthier on the defensive side of the ball. I don't know if there's another game on the schedule where I picked Oregon to win by 1 in this game against UCLA. I was not confident at all. You were very similar in your confidence level.
Yep.
Jared picked them to lose. This was the most up-in-the-air game we'd felt like in a long time. And the way that the defense has played, I am with you in that I don't think there's a game left on the schedule that they will be underdogs in. They should go in and win every single game. I'm not sitting here telling you they're going to blow out every single team or that they're going to win half their remaining five games in amazing fashion, blowout fashion.
What did I say? Blowout? What's a blowout?
Yeah.
Oregon doesn't know what that is.
But these should be games that Colorado, awful.
Mm-hmm.
This is a game that high probability of a win. Then they go on the road to Washington, and that game on this schedule at the beginning of the year looked like it was going to be
one of the tougher games.
And this should not be the case with Washington. It's going to be, look, Washington's going to be fired up. It's a rivalry game. You know, neither of these staffs like each other, what have you. But Oregon should put them away. And then they come home and they play a Washington State team who's fired their head coach. They've got four assistant coaches who are gone, unavailable to play in that game. Wide talent disparity in that one. They should win. You know, that's one. They should put them away. They go to Utah. That's a game that's going to be difficult, I think. But it's winnable. It's a should-win game. I mean, you should probably win by 8-10 points, and then you come home and you play Oregon State, which feels like the toughest game left on the schedule, which we never really would have thought of at the beginning of the year. But knowing how well Oregon plays and the talent that they have, especially on the defensive side of the football, and Kayvon Thibodeau and Noah Sewell and whatnot, it's another game that they should win. I'm having a hard time looking at another game on this schedule saying, like, boy, it's going to take an A-plus effort from Oregon to win.
Totally. No, I mean, I think Oregon can win with – I mean, UCLA on paper is one of the more – might be the best team that they've had on the schedule, to be honest with you. I mean, Oregon State right now and Utah, I think, challenge them in that regard. It's perplexing because I just looked at – I saw another stat here. Oregon averaged almost 7 yards per play and UCLA averaged below 4. Offensively, and this was a three-point game where Oregon had to sweat it late, and Oregon ran far fewer plays, in part because this UCLA offense killed some clock. It's kind of funny because this is Chip Kelly, who at Oregon was the exact opposite team. Who cares about time of possession? Who cares about how many plays you ran? Well, Oregon ran, 73 plays, and UCLA ran 91. This game is just perplexing for me, even looking at the stat sheet right now of why was it so close. And the obvious answer is just turnovers and silly mistakes at inopportune times. And I will be curious to see going forward how they clean some of this up. How do they get off to better starts? Because that needs to change. Can you close a game? You know, and one of the things we said, talked about the run game here, and I understand the idea of trying to throw the football because they didn't have a lot of success running it, but the degree of difficulty on some of these throws felt unnecessary in the moment. And I guess I just wonder, like, can this team consistently put teams away? Like, can they start fast and can they put teams away? It's right. Two questions that you feel like you come away with, which feels really strange this far into a season with a team that's going to be ranked 8th nationally on Sunday when those rankings come out. A couple other positives, I think. I thought Noah Sewell played really well.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he was all over the place. I shouted out the front seven a lot. I think another individual player, Jeffrey Bassa.
I was just going to bring him up. Good. He needs to be talked.
He does.
Two starts in a row.
Yeah.
At inside linebacker.
And this was his best.
Yes. He was very, very good. And I think we've started to see a trend the last couple of weeks. No offense to Nate Hukulani,
mm-hmm.
the former walk-on senior linebacker. He is starting to see fewer and fewer snaps.
Didn't play very much.
On the field. And Keith Brown is someone who played, I think, really good at Ohio State. But since that game, hasn't had his best performances.
No.
And I think the last 2 weeks has really struggled for whatever reason. I mean, he's a freshman. He's in a very tough spot because he didn't play his senior year of high school football because of COVID. And so he's knocking off rust. He's playing in a role that no one expected him to have to play in because of injuries and transfers. And that's prompted Jeffrey Bassa to move from safety down to linebacker, down a level within this defense – And Boston is another true freshman. And this is 100% why I believe wholeheartedly stars matter. Okay? But this scenario proves a point that just because a kid is a high four-star recruit, what have you, doesn't mean he's just a plug-and-play player.
Right.
Every player is different. They are going to take time. But over the longevity of signing elite recruiting class after elite recruiting class after elite recruiting class, you get the guys that are high-profile athletes that show up and are game ready week 3, week 4, week 5, what have you, of the season. And my point is Jeffrey Bossa is one of those guys, it feels like.
Yeah.
Like, as a true freshman, he's a 3-star recruit. He feels like...
I think he got bumped to a low 4-star.
That's right.
But very low. Like, I think one of the lowest 4-stars.
This proves the point that all guys are different. Some are ready to go right away, and he feels like he's one of them, where maybe he's a little outmatched from a weight physicality standpoint, but he's a better athlete than Nate. He's better in coverage than Keith Brown.
Much better.
And that is what's been lacking at the linebacker spot, because Noah Sewell is solid, but it's nowhere near his strength in pass coverage. And that's why Isaac Slade Matuatia was so important to pair with Sewell. And now you have another linebacker to kind of not equal what Isaac Slade Matuatia did, but pair well with Sewell, where you've got one really good coverage guy, you've got one really good run guy, and they're both solid at the other aspect of the defense.
I think with Bossa, the thing that was surprising in this game was that this was a game where I thought, okay, we know Keith Brown's better against the run than Bossa. That's what we think. I figured this was a game where he wasn't going to play a lot. Instead, he was fifth on the team, or tied for third, actually, on the team in tackles with 6. He had a tackle for loss, had a quarterback hit that was impressive, was just all over the field. I'll have to watch on the rewatch that Jared and I do. I'll have to see if maybe there were some errors that I didn't notice during the game. But I came away thinking he played at a very high level, and it begs the question of what's the plan for him long term. Could he just settle in here? I mean, obviously he doesn't start over Justin Flo next year, presumably. But is he going to? Could he be just a long term inside linebacker, or is what we're seeing even more encouraging when we think about him as the future star at nickel? Regardless, I think Jeffrey Bossa is a really good football player, and you're starting to see someone really come into his own at this position. Again, not a position he was recruited to play. I think very encouraging. It's been the clear weak point of this defense is that position all season, ever since Justin Flo went down, and Drew Mathis went down, and Jackson LeDuc was lost in fall camp, and Isaac Slade Matuatia transfer. We've run through all this before. A ton of turnover here. Finally, I think you're starting to see someone play at a high level there, and I think that's really important.
Moving forward, this team now gets ready for Colorado. Injury standpoint,
yeah.
I think we'll end it here, unless you've got anything pressing.
No, I think we should do injuries and wrap it up.
Jackson Powers Johnson goes down with what looked like a pretty bad injury.
Agreed.
No weight on it as he was coming off. He was in a boot in the second half of that game. Real tough deal because this was a guy, I think he started and was playing really well. And I think we said at the beginning of the year, and I will eat crow because I pushed this as hard as anybody out there. Kingsley Salamatia, we viewed, was like,
we thought
almost a day one starter.
We thought he was going to start this season at some point.
And Jackson Powers Johnson was that true freshman this year. Like, I think he was the one that kind of forced his way into the rotation. And then as games have started being played, has now kind of forced his way into the starting lineup. And this week, at least early on, it looked like things were really going that way in a good direction for him. So I'd be kind of surprised if he plays next week against Colorado. And it might be a case where he's out maybe a couple of weeks. Stephen Jones also went down with an injury.
Didn't return. They reshuffled. Well, actually, that's one thing we should talk about, the offensive line briefly. But you can.
There was a lot of shuffling there.
Yeah.
Mace Funa.
That looked bad.
Yeah, that didn't look good as well. No real update on him.
Yeah, we didn't get an injury update, did we?
But you could tell it was not a... And for him, it's unfortunate because it feels like he's back, he's hurt, he's back, he's hurt. he's, you know, playing every other week because of injury, and that prevents him, A, getting football shape, B, you know, gelling within the defense and just the overall impact of things. So you hope he's okay. But to the offensive line, lots of shuffling, and I think this group showed why it's pretty good.
Yeah, okay, this is just so random here, but I have to bring this up. Why is Jackson Powers Johnson credited with the tackle for loss on defense? That has to be the wrong player attributed. I just noticed.
Interception?
Yeah, but why is it a tackle for loss? I understand if it was a tackle.
Oh, a tackle for loss.
Makes no sense that he was not on defense. Right? I just noticed it looking at the stats of like...
Interesting. Well, the stats were all messed up.
The stats were terrible. It must have been like either Popo Amabi or Trevin Mai who were 48 and 50 instead of 58. Sorry, that's a little bit of a tangent for no reason. Alex Forsythe did not play in this game as well. His third straight game not playing. Mark Christopher said that they thought he was going to play and something happened right before kick. Okay. Three straight weeks where he hasn't played. It's significant. He's a leader on this offensive line. Ryan Walk's been almost seamless filling in, by the way, at center. I'm really impressed with Ryan Walk. I've become a pretty big Ryan Walk fan over here. I just think he's really solid. He plays hard. But what they did around him was interesting here. They started the game with T.J. Bassett, left tackle.
Yes.
It's a guy who's played left guard for...
You're like, what?
What's he doing? What?
Guards don't typically... Linemen don't go in to out. They usually go out to in along a position change.
Uh-huh. And the weird part is George Moore is healthy, who's been the left tackle all season.
I don't think he's been very good the last couple weeks.
I won't argue that point, but it was interesting. He wasn't in the starting lineup. Jackson Powers Johnson then slides in next to him. And then the right side is, I think they really like that combination of Stephen Jones next to Big Sala at right guard, right tackle, because they went back to that. They kept that intact, and they said, hey, TJ's going to play left tackle. We're going to have Jackson Powers-Johnson at left guard, Ryan Walk at center. That's how it started. By the end of the game, it was completely different.
Yes.
It was left tackle. George Moore's back in the game. It's left guard, Dawson Yaramillo. It's center is Ryan Walk. Right guard is TJ Bass, and right tackle is Big Sala. So tons of rotations, moving guys around. I think it's going to be really telling when we hear some injury news on kind of what the status for Powers Johnson, Forsythe, and Jones are going forward, because that's three guys who are starters or borderline starters or at least fill-in players that we don't know about going forward. Regardless, they clearly feel pretty comfortable with the five they had on the field. I don't think it was perfect. Again, the run game was not great. But I think collectively I didn't feel terrible about what I saw from this group, and I will be curious to see going forward kind of what this rotation looks like.
Was this the best offensive line performance of the year? It might have been.
I mean, from a pass protection perspective, they were awesome. I mean, they just didn't run the ball very effectively, so I have a hard time saying that. I mean, they didn't have hardly any running success on designed run plays for the running backs.
That's true.
You know? And Ohio State was really good on the run.
Pass protecting, they were really good.
They were really good.
They were really good in pass protection. But you're right. The offensive line didn't open up a lot of holes. There weren't very many spots for Travis Tye to run. I also think they kind of just went away from running in general.
Well, like, the fact that he had four straight carries with four touchdowns over the course of, like, a quarter and a half, which tells you all you need to know about how much he was getting the football.
It's going to do it for us here on the Odds and Audibles podcast. Thank you for listening to this post-game edition. Look out for us on Monday with the mailbag. Send in your questions to Eric on Twitter, or also hit us up through DM on duckterritory.com for your questions there as well. Until Monday, you've been listening to the Odds and Audibles podcast.
Talk to you later, folks.
When you have sports mixed with your pop culture, along with humor and celebrity interviews, your earbuds are enjoying the Rich Eisen Show.
Dan Orlovsky, are you still a Jaden Daniels is the best quarterback available in the draft guy?
I think the three things that make it stand out for me are, number one, I think his ball placement versus man coverage is the best in the draft. Every quarterback in the NFL is accurate. He's got the best on tape. Number two, most transferable stuff to the NFL. And then I think the third thing is pocket peace.
Search for the Rich Eisen Show on YouTube or wherever you listen.